From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. Craig Picard from Washington University in St. Louis is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling about solving a large-scale gene silencing mystery.
Dr. Craig Picard is a professor of biology at Washington University in St. Louis. His laboratory studies the ways genes are activated and repressed using techniques of genetics, biochemistry, cell biology, and molecular biology. The group's current research projects are focused on the roles played by chromatin-modifying enzymes and non-coding RNAs in gene silencing. Dr. Picard, your team recently made a key advance regarding the phenomenon of nucleolar dominance in a hybrid Arabidopsis plant. Please define nucleolar dominance and then talk about the role it plays in both health and disease.
This nucleolar dominance is a phenomenon that occurs specifically in genetic hybrids. Usually hybrids, in fact, form between two species yet are still closely related enough to interbreed. And what happens is that in these hybrids, the ribosomal RNA genes from one of the parents are expressed, but the ribosomal RNA genes that are inherited from the other parent are not expressed. So this was actually discovered back in the 1920s in plants, but it doesn't just happen in plants. It happens in flies, so the fruit fly, Drosophila, different species of those. Also in frogs, so in the genus Xenopus, and also even happens in mammals to some extent. And one of the interesting things about it is that it doesn't matter whether the genes come in from the maternal parent, the mother, or whether they come in through the paternal parent. It's always the same genes that are inherited from the same species that is on or is off. So somehow a choice is made when these genes come in. The way the name of the phenomena comes from the fact that the ribosomal RNA genes, when they turn on, that leads to a very visible change in the nucleus, at least under the microscope, and it forms a structure called the nucleolus. So it's inside the nucleolus where ribosomal RNA is actually processed. So these are the products of these genes. And then that, in turn, with about 80 proteins, comes together to form ribosomes, which are the little factories that are responsible for protein synthesis in all cells. So they're really critical for life in that regard. So we've been very interested, just from a basic science point of view, to understand the regulation of these genes that are so important for protein synthesis and the life of the cell. So, well, one of the things that we found recently, in really over the course of the last 10 years, is that this phenomenon, this nucleolar dominance phenomenon, although it occurs in hybrids, which is a rather specialized circumstance, it's not a hybrid-specific phenomenon per se, in that whatever is going on in regulating these ribosomal genes happens in all species all the time. And what we found is that the point of it is to control the number of ribosomal RNA genes that are active at any one time. So it turns out these particular genes are present in hundreds of copies, one after another, and they take up really large chunks of the chromosomes. And not all of them are on at any one time. And so some are on, some are off. And it turns out that in keeping some of them on or off, it turns out that the same molecular mechanisms for that, what we call dosage control of these genes, are the same mechanisms that kick in the hybrid to cause nucleolar dominance. So that's something we learned along the way in studying the phenomena. So when, in terms of the health benefit, it's mostly basic science, not applied science that we're doing. But there are some interesting aspects of ribosomal RNA gene expression with regard to cancer, in that in cancer cells, they are actually typified by having very large nucleoli. So again, these nucleoli being plural for nucleolus, this is the place where the ribosomal RNA genes are expressed. The size of the nucleolus has to do with how much activity is there and how much these ribosomal genes are on and how many ribosomes are being made. And cancer cells are very rapidly dividing, rapidly growing. They need a lot of proteins, and so they upregulate this whole system. So, in fact, pathologists, they often will look at a biopsy, in fact, looking at cells for the presence of very large nucleoli as an indicator of a cancer cell. So in principle, if there were, if we could understand how the genes are controlled, it might be possible, perhaps someday, to be able to maybe knock down the expression of these genes a little bit. Don't let them proliferate quite so rapidly, and maybe slow the progression of a tumor cell. But we're very far from that sort of an applied goal of this very basic research at this time.
A paper published in the December 5th issue of Molecular Cell by your research team looked at multi-megabase silencing in nucleolar dominance and the involvement of small interfering RNAs in the regulation of ribosomal RNA genes. What was it you and your group were trying to find out?
Well, this sort of goes back to 1997 when we first realized that nucleolar dominance was due to selectively silencing one parental set of ribosomal RNA genes. And the way we found that was to show that the silencing is somehow involves adding methyl groups onto DNA. So this is a silencing mark in many higher organisms. And in addition to the modifying the DNA with methyl groups, the histone proteins, these are proteins that wrap the DNA, sort of the first step of organizing the DNA in the nucleus, these histones are also modified in various ways. And what we did was we used chemicals that would inhibit either DNA methylation or the removal of two carbon acetyl groups from the histones. And if we block DNA methylation or we block this deacetylation of the histones, that was sufficient to turn on the set of ribosomal genes that had been silent. So we knew at that point that somehow DNA methylation and histone modifications were involved. So since that time, we've been trying to chase down the enzymes that are actually responsible for those modifications. So in our current paper, we were setting out to try to identify the DNA methylation machinery that might be involved. And we did this by a technique in which we can specifically target and knock down individual members of gene families that might be accountable for the activity, and then testing those for effects on nucleolar dominance. And in that study, we actually identified one of the DNA methyl transferases that is required for the process. And in previous work, we had identified one of the histone deacetylases that's responsible. And the two proteins that we found actually had been identified by other groups doing genetic screens in the past as being involved in a phenomenon that's known as RNA-directed DNA methylation. So now this is a process that occurs in plants whereby these very short RNAs called short interfering RNAs or siRNAs somehow can direct the methylation and the silencing of matching DNA. And so the fact that we had found these two enzymes that were implicated in that pathway made us start to now think about the possible role of these short interfering RNAs in nucleolar dominance. So we followed our lead based on these enzymes that we'd found by just knowing which activities were required and then trying to find out which particular enzymes did that. And that led us, in fact, to this realization that somehow small RNAs were involved. And so then we went in, we tested that directly and found evidence that, in fact, these small RNAs are involved in the silencing process.
Although biologists have been studying nucleolar dominance since the 1920s, this phenomenon remained largely unresolved until your group reversed an old scientific dogma. What was this dogma, and how did your research team turn it upside down?
Well, from the early 1980s until our paper in 1997, the thinking was that one set of ribosomal RNA genes was selectively turned on. So one was activated and the other was sort of off by default. And the idea behind that was the notion that the two sets of genes for the different parents, they differ in sequence and they might differ in their ability to interact with and bind to some kind of an activating protein that's present in limiting supply. So the idea was that one set of genes was just better at binding this factor, and so it got all of it, and the other one didn't get its share, and so it was off. So it was really thought to be all about this differential activation. And what we found in 1997 with these fairly simple tests where we use these chemical inhibitors of DNA methylation and histone deacetylation, was that, in fact, the phenomenon is really about the selective silencing of one set of genes rather than the selective activation of the other. So that was a bit of a change in the way we'd been thinking about it and actually working on the phenomena for years. And that's really set the stage for everything we've done in the last 10 years to understand this phenomena better.
Now, you mentioned cancer before, but again, what are the major implications of your research study for applied medical research in the broadest sense?
Well, and again, it's quite a basic science goal at the moment, more than applied, but there are a number of really interesting gene silencing phenomena that occur, and some of which are fairly important in terms of our understanding of how to deal with things like cancer. For instance, probably the most cancer-relevant aspect of gene silencing is that cells have a variety of genes that actually function to slow the progression of cell division. And that's exactly what runs away in a cancer cell, where you just divide wildly. So a number of these genes have been called tumor suppressor genes, in that they actually normally function to slow or inhibit what's called the cell cycle or cell division. And it turns out that in many forms of cancer, these genes that are critical as tumor suppressors become inactivated. And they become inactivated by the same modifications that we found to be important for nuclear dominance. So again, DNA methylation occurs on these things, and also these histone modifications occur. So if we understood how that happens better, we might be able to come up with strategies that will work well to alleviate those tumor suppressor genes. Another case where possibly in the future we might be able to take an understanding of gene silencing and use it for some therapeutic good would be cases where in adults you might have a genetically inherited defect in some important gene. And one example that I often think of is the diseases known as thalassemias, where patients have defects in genes for the globin, so in blood, the thing that binds the oxygen. And it turns out that the globin gene family is regulated in a very interesting way during development, that there's a series of genes that are turned on at different times in development, from the time the embryo forms and fetus and then later on into adulthood. And very often, the genes that were expressed very early in development were just fine, so no defects, but the adult gene may have a mutation where the patient suffers from thalassemia. Now, if only there were a way to go back and turn on one of those perfectly good genes that they had used earlier in development, those patients would do better. So that would be an example where if we only understood these complex ways the genes are silent, we might be able to do something useful with that for therapeutic intervention. Other interesting phenomena that we don't fully understand are things like X chromosome inactivation in females. So again, females have two X chromosomes, whereas males only have one. But it turns out both males and females express X chromosome linked genes to the same extent. And the way they do that, at least in mammals, is that in females, one of the X chromosomes becomes inactivated. So really there's only one dose, only one functional X chromosome, which is just like a male, which only has one X chromosome. And if you had both on, you'd have a problem, in fact. So this is actually the basis for the calico cat phenotype. So people may be familiar with seeing calico cats with their little splotches of color on their coats, and they're kind of random, and no two calico cats look exactly alike. It turns out those coat color genes are on the X chromosome, and depending on which of the two X chromosomes gets inactivated, and it can be random, you get these different splotches of color. So that's why calico cats are females when that happens. So if there are defects in that process, there also are various disorders that can occur on so-called either X chromosome-related genes or other so-called imprinted genes where you only express one of them inherited from mom or from dad, that sort of thing. So there's a variety of cases where silencing occurs on these big chromosomal chunks in nature, and we would really like to know how this happens. In some cases, it relates to disease. In some cases, it's just a really baffling phenomenon that we wish we understood better. And these all come under the heading of what are known as epigenetic phenomena. So they're not quite genetic in that you can pin down the differences in how a gene is expressed based on a mutation or a DNA sequence, but two genes with the same sequence could have different outcomes, whether they're on or they're off. So these are sort of, I like to tell my students that these are sort of the X-files of molecular genetics. We don't really know how these phenomena work, but they're really interesting. So most of our interest is really just trying to pursue how in the world does this work, and the practical outcomes may or will probably be some ways down the line, I'm afraid.
Taking your research results from your molecular cell paper, where do you and your research team go from here?
Yeah, of course, that's a great question. Well, we found in our paper that these small interfering RNAs were somehow critical. As soon as we suspected they were there, we went looking for them, and sure enough, there's lots of small RNAs that are throughout the portion, matching the portion of the gene that has the most regulatory potential, including what's called the promoter, which is where the gene really starts. But we don't know what gave rise to those small RNAs. It means that they had a precursor RNA of some sort that gave rise to them. And we don't know where those RNAs are coming from, where they start, where they end, and whether or not those are regulated. So that's something we definitely need to know. The other thing that we still don't really understand about this phenomenon is how in the world does the cell make the choice as to which set of ribosomal genes to silence? They're really quite similar in sequence, yet one of them gets reproducibly shut down. Now, because it doesn't matter whether it comes in through the mom or through the dad, it's always the same one that gets silenced. The old theories were that there was something about the sequence that mattered. Finding that these small RNAs are somehow involved raises the possibility that they may have the specificity to perfectly pair with only one of the two sets of genes and maybe select that for an activation. So this may be part of what we call the choice mechanism for silencing. So we're very eager to pursue that. Next thing we really don't know in plants or in any organism is how in the world these small RNAs, which we know can silence genes that match them in sequence, but how do they do it in biochemical terms? How do these RNAs ultimately guide enzymes that accomplish DNA methylation or histone modifications to actually find their targets and do their work? That is really a black box in all of biology, and there are groups working on this all the way from yeast to plants to flies to humans, and we really don't understand how that happens. So those are the things that are going to keep us busy for several years, I'm sure.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.